Welcome. Welcome and good morning. We welcome you to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. You're welcome here no matter who you love, no matter how you define yourself, and whatever burdens you carry. We are a community of seekers bound together by our common humanity. As we begin, would you please take a moment to look at the announcements within the order of service? Today, following service, we have the annual Thanksgiving soup lunch. A variety of soups, sides, and beverages will be served. Whether you are a longtime member or if you're just visiting our fellowship for the first time, please stay and join us for lunch. I'd also like to note the feedback circle occurring next week, December 4th, after the Sunday service. That feedback circle is to give feedback on our Sunday services. So mark your calendar if you care to stay a little longer next week for that. I have another special announcement. This announcement was given to me by Michael Oldfather, and it's an announcement about Slavomir's studio fall recital. It'll be at 4 p.m. right here. Is that today?
Saturday.
Next Saturday. Okay. It will be at 4 p.m. next Saturday, December 3rd. It's sponsored by the UUFM Music Committee, and our pianist today, Matthew Meals, will be one of the featured performers. It is free. It will go until about 5:30, 4 p.m. to 5:30. I would like to ask Deirdre Greeley to come up and share with us a special reminder today.
Good morning. I'm just here to remind you that the Guest at Our Table fundraiser is kicking off today. We have a table set out front in the narthex. It has the little cans that were made by the RE students. If you want to take one of those home and add donations daily or weekly and bring it back, you are more than welcome to do so. We also have the donation forms if you'd like to take a look at those. Take one home with you. There are some envelopes that you can put it in. You can fill it out here or you can take it home. There's a basket out there. However you want to do it, there's also a link if you go to UUSC and click on Guest at Your Table. There will be a donation link right there online. So there are several ways that you can donate to this. And we're going to have more information as this goes on. It goes on through the end of the year. So we will be hopefully highlighting some of the people that that we are sponsoring or we're looking at this year at Guest at Your Table. So thank you, everybody.
Each morning when you rise, give thanks for the light, for your life, for your sustenance, for your strength, and for the joy of living. So goes a Native American morning prayer of the Shawnee tradition. At times, our own light goes out and is rekindled by a spark from another. Let each of us remember with deep gratitude those who have lighted the flame within us. Words of Albert Schweitzer. Please stand as you are able to sing What Gift Can We Bring, number 404.
Thank you.
A beloved community not only nurtures one another's spiritual and intellectual growth, we also embrace each other's humanity by sharing those highest joys, as well as the heavy burdens of our heart. Please raise your hand if you have a joy or concern to share. I think Aurelia is especially joyful to be here with us today.
She wants to tell you that she has a shell and she likes it.
Very nice. Yay!
That Corbin come here, that he's new here.
We have a guest today. His name is Corbin.
I just wanted to introduce my mother, who's here today visiting, Mark Mayfield. This is Cleo Mayfield.
Welcome.
She's from Tennessee.
Great. Okay. By sharing, may our joys multiply, and may our burdens feel lighter on the strength of shared shoulders. We welcome Mark Mayfield's mother and any other guests who are here with us today. Thank you for joining us today. And now is that time for the young and the young at heart, the story for all ages, which will be led by Sandy Nelson.
Come on down. Good morning, good morning. Did anybody have Thanksgiving food last week? No, you didn't? Pizza, yummy, that's the best Thanksgiving food. We had Chinese at our house. So this is the time of year that a lot of grown-ups tend to ask a lot of kids what they're thankful for. And generally, we all say big stuff, like family and my health and the internet. That's a good one. So this story is kind of about the little things. So I want you guys to think about the little things, and maybe we'll go around and see if we can get any. Get any answers from anybody else. This is called, I never say I'm thankful, but I am. I am thankful for family at Thanksgiving time and other holiday times, but most of the time, no one talks about it. Even though I feel thankful, I hardly ever say it out loud. I feel it when Mom helps me. Maybe she feels it when I help her. I feel it when Dad fixes my bike. Maybe he feels it when I help him paint the fence. My granddad helps me make things. I think he knows how thankful I feel. My grandma listens when I'm full of things to tell her. When I'm sad, she understands. I never say I'm thankful for my brother, but I am. Of course, I'm not that thankful when we fight or when he teases me and calls me names, but once he fixed my wagon. He even helped me paint it. I never say I'm thankful for my friends, but I am. I'm lonely when a friend moves away. I never say I'm thankful for my dog, even though he's my best pal. I never say I'm thankful for crickets and frogs, but I let them go so they can find their way home. I never say I'm thankful for the beach or the waves. Or the mountains of sand or the seagulls racing in the wind. Or the pinchy crab hiding under a shell. No, I hardly ever say I'm thankful, but I am. So those were lots of little things to be thankful for. Anybody have a little thing to be thankful for? Arthur?
Air molecules.
Air molecules. Those are teeny tiny things. Piper? Oh, Piper's thankful for her family. I'm sure we are. I'm thankful for my family, too. Anybody else? Corbin? Carrie?
Sorry. Laura?
I'm thankful for my cats.
Ooh, thankful for cats. I'm a cat person. I'm thankful for cats. Carrie? No? Liam? Sam? Nick? Noah? Oh, my God.
I'm thankful for my cat, Simba. I'm thankful for my friend, Jocelyn.
Internet.
Internet, electronics, cheese. Oh, man, who's not thankful for cheese?
I'm thankful for my family.
Thankful for family. That's a big one. Corbin.
Riley.
Thankful for Riley. Who here is thankful for friends? Friends are really, really important. So what do you say? We sing ourselves out and spend time with our friends.
No.
Good idea.
The famed novelist Marcel Proust wrote, "Let us be grateful to the people who make us happy. They are the charming gardeners who make our souls blossom." This Unitarian Universalist Fellowship is a safe haven and a bold model of love. Please give generously to sustain our community and feed our vital work.
Thank you.
Thank you, Matthew. That was beautiful. My name is Katie Kingery Page. I forgot to introduce myself earlier, so first let me say I'm grateful for this community that accepts my imperfection all the time. Today's service on your stories of gratitude comes on the heels of the Thanksgiving holiday and at the conclusion of a presidential election process that has left many people feeling drained and has even left some feeling disillusioned. We live in a popular culture that encourages us to focus upon feelings of gratitude as a panacea for discontent. But how do we move past the serious upheavals of life to find a meaningful practice of gratitude? Today we hear fellow members reflect upon surprising experiences of gratitude, and we have the opportunity, the entire group here today, to invite you to add your own reflection of gratitude as we conclude the service.
Good morning. I'm going to read a section from the autobiography of Malcolm X, in which Malcolm expresses something close to gratitude for his own imprisonment, but I don't want to generalize. Who knows how many thousands of lives have been ruined by long imprisonment for crimes they didn't commit, who were victims of a deeply flawed system of justice, or who were misrepresented or even framed by indifferent, incompetent, or dishonest police and prosecutors. We know that over-incarceration and mass incarceration for minor or nonviolent offenses are a major problem in this country. However, here's what Malcolm X had to say about his incarceration. Malcolm X was a black Muslim revolutionary of the 1960s. He was incubated as a teenager in what he called the prison of the Harlem ghetto, a world of crime, drugs, and hustlers. He later said that even that depraved experience, as well as his later stint behind bars in an actual penitentiary, was a blessing, both because of the life lessons he learned in that hard knock life and because of the legitimacy it gave him in the minds of his listeners later in life when he preached his version of salvation to the disenfranchised and apathetic. At one point, he wanted to learn how a newspaper was put together because he wanted to start one for the Nation of Islam. And so he did a stint visiting and working at the Los Angeles Herald-Dispatch. He said, quote, "I can watch something being done once and pick up on how to do it myself. Mastering the quick study was the number one survival rule when I was a hustler in the streets of Harlem," unquote. Malcolm X might not exactly have felt gratitude for his imprisonment for burglary, but he does trace the beginnings of his rehabilitation, salvation, and enlightenment to his experiences in prison, including solitary confinement. In prison, he got off drugs, got off nicotine. He began to read widely. He learned vocabulary and grammar. He mastered public speaking and debate in the prison debate club. He accepted Islam. He committed himself to a life of physical and spiritual purity and public service. His eyes were open to knowledge, to world cultures and history, and especially to some of the deep history of black culture and black exploitation by Europeans and Euro-Americans. He was imprisoned for 7 years, and at first he was so hateful and uncooperative that his fellow prisoners nicknamed him Satan. Here are Malcolm X's own words on the subject of the changes that he underwent in prison. Quote, "In prison I met a fellow convict named Bimby. Bimby was known as the prison library's best customer. After we'd done our day's license plate quota, a crowd would gather around Bimby and listen to him talk. Even white prisoners wanted to hear his opinions on any subject. And not just the prisoners, even the prison guards gathered around the circle to listen to him. Bimby once told me flatly that he thought I had some brains, if only I would use them and stop being self-defeating and self-destructive. I didn't want that kind of advice, and I would have cursed him, but nobody cursed Bimby. And for his part, no foul word ever escaped his lips. The thing that most fascinated me about Bimby is that he was the first man I had ever met who commanded total respect with his words alone," unquote. In prison, Malcolm X had become frustrated by his poor vocabulary when trying to read or trying to express himself, especially in letters to friends and family. Quote, he says, "In the street, I had been the most articulate hustler out there. I had commanded attention when I said something. I was fluent in ghetto jive. But now I was trying to write plain English. Not only was I not articulate, I wasn't even functional. Almost every sentence in every book I opened in the prison library had words or even entire sentences that might as well have been written in Chinese. I finally decided to write out and reread the entire dictionary. I'd never realized so many words existed. I studied what I had copied. I reviewed the meanings of words that I couldn't remember. With every succeeding page, I also learned of people and places and events from history. Many who hear me speak today will assume that my schooling went far beyond the eighth grade. This is due entirely to my prison studies. A new world opened to me in prison. From then until I left prison, I was reading every free moment I had. You couldn't have pried me out of my books with a wedge. Months passed without my even thinking about being imprisoned. In fact, up to then, I had never been so truly free in my entire life. In London recently, a British reporter and writer asked me, "What's your alma mater?" I told him, "Books." I still marvel at how swiftly my thinking patterns from my previous life slid away from me, like snow off a roof. I began to think of my past self in the prison of the ghetto as a different person altogether, not a past version of myself. Unquote. Malcolm X was frequently invited to panel discussions and debates later in life when he became well known, where he had to defend the Nation of Islam against accusations of anti-white racism and militancy. He writes, quote, "From my old hustling days, I knew that there were tricks to everything. In prison debating, I learned tricks to upset my debate opponents. As a Nation of Islam minister, I interrupted introductions designed to load the dice by distorting my positions and vilifying the Nation of Islam, and I insisted on a correct characterization. During debate, I talked nonstop until what I wanted to get said got said," unquote. Malcolm X also wrote about a silver lining to drug addiction, a kernel of hope that germinated in every addict. Quote, "You may have read about the Nation of Islam's phenomenal record of dope addiction cures of longtime junkies. The New York Times carried a story about how some of the government social agencies have asked us for clinical suggestions. The most important ingredient of the Nation of Islam's drug addiction rehabilitation program was the involvement, guidance, and persuasion of ex-junkies themselves. In the ghetto's dope jungle, Muslim ex-junkies would fish out addicts whom they had known back in the day. Our ex-junkie Muslims would conduct the addict through a six-point therapeutic process with an agonizing patience that might span a few months or might last a year. Finally cured, the now ex-addict would complete the cycle by fishing up other addicts himself, whom he knew personally, and supervise their salvation," unquote. One of the abiding themes in Malcolm X's life was finding silver linings in dark clouds. Now, you might not be thankful for your disappointments, but you are thankful for not succumbing to them. You're grateful for the gumption and resolve to get up and try again after a failure or after 10 failures, which means you are grateful for the opportunity to take on the risk of failure. What's more disappointing or even tragic than seeing someone's fear of failure dissuade them from taking on a difficult challenge that could have led to a great success? I'm going to tell you an anecdote from my remembrance. It was exactly 50 years ago. I was a freshman at the University of Wisconsin in Madison and lived in the dorm. We used to play pickup basketball with my dorm mates, and one of the freshmen was an unusually gifted player. He wasn't especially tall for a basketball player. He was maybe 6'2 or 6'3, but he could jump like a grasshopper on a pogo stick. He could easily dunk the ball. He was superbly coordinated, skilled, graceful, quick of hand, eye and foot. He could dribble through a crowd without being touched. He had a sixth sense about the game. He was a phenomenal player. He was also a sweet, generous guy, and he was way out of our league, but he played with us anyway. So we asked him whether he planned to try out for the freshman team. And, you know, we thought he'd be a star. He definitely would have been a star. His response utterly stunned me and everybody else in the group, and I've never forgotten it. What he said was that he was not going to try out for the team, even though he wanted to and, you know, even though he loved the game. The reason he wasn't going to try out for the team was because then he would always be able to imagine and believe that he might have been good enough to make it. In other words, he could forever cling to the shadow of this dream deferred or dream suppressed. Whereas if he tried out for the team and didn't make it, didn't make the cut, he would have to go through life knowing that for certain that he wasn't good enough, that he had failed. His dream would be proven to have been futile and hopeless. Well, I was appalled that someone who'd be given such a gift as his talent would intentionally bury it, merely out of fear that the gift might not bear fruit, that he might not live up to the possibilities inherent in such a gift. And now, 50 years later, in the context of today's program, I might say that he showed a foolish ingratitude for the opportunity to be in the game, to take on the risk of failure, to jump into life.
Katie and Dick are so tall. Good morning, everyone. My name is Alex Snyder Hernandez, and I'm going to take some advice that Shirley gave me and just let you all know I'm terrified. So when Katie asked me to talk for this service, I wasn't sure I would have anything to say or how coherent any contribution I have might be. But we started to talk about the phrase, just be grateful, and how it's thrown around in everyday conversation. And I began to be inspired to say something, so I'm just going to go for it. I have a very complicated relationship with the concept of gratitude, so much so that the word itself can feel very hostile to me. Many times this idea of gratitude has felt thrown at me in times where I've been struggling or very depressed. But it wasn't used to be helpful. It was used as a weapon to guilt me, to say to accept things as they are because it could be worse. As I've struggled to cut ties with toxic members of my family, such as my mom, I've received a number of calls from my grandma telling me to be grateful for them because other people don't have moms. Or, I don't know. I don't know why I should be grateful. Using gratitude as an instrument to suppress uncomfortable conversations with other family members or any sense of rebellion in me. I tried for a long time to be grateful, so much I could even trick myself into thinking that I was actually grateful for certain things. I rose-colored neglect into an idea that I wasn't left alone because people didn't care about me. I was left alone because they respected me enough to have my own freedom. When I started to come out as depressed and mentally ill, the advice from my family was that I can choose how I feel, and that choice should be being grateful for life. And they kept saying it so much that I began to resent this idea of gratitude. Whenever anyone said it, it felt dismissive and it hurt me so much that I stopped talking to people and I stopped telling them how much I was struggling. So conversations about gratitude make me really uncomfortable. Going around and saying what we're thankful for at dinner on this past holiday ties knots in my stomach. And as I've grown up to create a healthier environment for myself, I've encountered moments where I felt sincerely grateful to people, and it's been really difficult for me to express that. The moment I start to feel grateful, I wonder why I'm feeling it. Is it because I feel obligated? Is it because I feel indebted? Or is it because I sincerely feel thankful for this person or for something in my life? And when I realize that it's sincere, I'm affronted by the fact that I would sincerely feel grateful. It creates a sense of vulnerability for me, which is disconcerting. I feel that I owe the person that's making me feel grateful, and I'm scared that I might rely on them. I always try to prepare for the worst, for no one to be there for me, because that's the safe thing. When anyone is genuinely kind to me, I'm looking for the strings. What's their ulterior motive? Does this person want something? And what is it going to cost me for their kindness? Then if I can't seem to find any motivation, I question my deservingness of someone's genuine want to help me. I don't believe that I am worthy of people's kindness because of how I was raised. And I can even figure out how to do this when things in my life are working out. I'm like, why is the universe on my side? This is not how this is supposed to be. I prepare for the bottom to drop out. I'm so busy preparing for the end that there's no time to feel grateful. It seems like a joke when you're convinced everything is going to fall apart. But as I become more accustomed to kindness in my life, I've begun to realize how surprised and unnerved feelings of gratitude make me. I started to notice it a long time ago when I went to dinner with Katie, and she couldn't stop talking about how great she thinks I am. At first, I just thought I was embarrassed or it was hard to hear compliments about myself. But then, as time has recently gone on, someone in my art class helped me get a job as a para with the school district, and it gave me the same type of knots in my stomach, the same feelings of being thankful to this person, but confounded as to why they would help me. And then they were so excited when things worked out, I couldn't quite understand what was in it for them. I try my best to practice being kind to others, and I'm always very happy to see others happy. It can just be hard to believe that someone would want that same kind of joy for me. So for me, I'm not ever going to tell anyone to be grateful or practice it in an everyday thing for myself. I'm going to try to become more accustomed to it and to be able to express my gratitude better. But I will say to people to practice self-care and to be empathetic. Create joy and love in your life and spread it to people you encounter.
Hello. My name is Matthew Ebersole, for those of you who don't know me. And I was asked a few weeks ago to share a surprising story of gratitude. And I agreed, you know, to do such a thing because gratitude is a word that I'm fairly familiar with. And, you know, I've done a great deal of attempting to practice it in my life. So I took it upon myself to inventory my life experiences and, you know, trying to figure out which one I could use to convey, you know, gratitude as an action within myself and the lessons that I learned and all these other things. And pretty shortly afterwards, I, you know, just put pen to paper and started to write. And I realized that really what I was trying to do was I was trying to tell a story in a grateful way, which kind of dawned on me that that really wasn't gratitude, you know. So then I tried to actively be grateful for something that had already happened back in the past. And what I ended up doing was actually just listing off of, you know, the pros and the cons, and it became quite objective. You know, it wasn't really spiritual anymore. And it was, you know, just I was looking at, well, I'm glad this happened versus this happened. So that being said, I kind of got forced into cheating a little bit and writing a story about writing this story. So right there, I had to examine, you know, what I thought gratitude was, you know. And in my life, I can remember times that I've been grateful, but it was kind of a passive gratefulness. It wasn't so much as an active gratefulness. And so really, when it got down to it, I learned that, You know, there's definitely a difference between active gratitude and passive gratitude, because active gratitude is what I was having to practice right at that point in time. You know, I became extremely grateful that, you know, and looking back on it, I was forced into, you know, just by examining what I needed to write for this, how remiss I had been in the practice of this gratitude in my entire life. Because just saying thank you to someone whenever they do something nice for me, it's not ungrateful, you know, but it's so much deeper than that. You know, whenever somebody goes out of their way to do something for me, like in this case, you know, I was thinking more of this community and my family that I still have and everything that I've kind of wandered into in these past few months that I've been here in Manhattan. You know, I was really taken aback by how mindlessly I walked through just all the smiling faces and the niceties and how welcoming, you know, it was for people, and from people, I should say. You know, Dale Carnegie, he wrote a book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, and I don't remember exactly who he quoted, who came up with the idea that one of the main things that motivate people is a feeling of importance. And, you know, I realized how many little things people did when I got here that just made me feel important, you know, just a little bit. I know nobody, everyone was smiling, and, you know, I come from kind of a checkered past. You know, I was a troubled kid. So that was a lot of my problem when I was trying to think of stories that I could use to convey gratitude, is a lot of times I've had to just be grateful for how easy I got off, you know, and I didn't want to get up here and share that because I don't feel like that was necessarily at being my point. In doing all of this, I recognized that in order for me, myself, to be grateful, I had to take an action. It wasn't something that I could just call to be. It wasn't something that happened of itself, you know, and that's why I'm extremely grateful that I got asked to do this, because it forced my inventory. It really forced me to take a moment and actively participate in observing what wonder there is, you know, in just small things, even great things. You know, I had no idea that we were having lunch today, but that's awesome. You know, a little bit of gratitude right there. Anyway, so before I continue to ramble on, because I can go on speaking for who knows how long about what gratitude is for me, I, you know, had to continue on with the thought of my experience. And that is, what can I do to continue to do these things? And what can I do to keep my attitude grateful? You know, and furthermore, why should I? Because it's not always the easiest thing, you know, and how do I do so responsibly? Even more so, because I can easily ignore all of the cons about something and only look at the pros, and I can call that gratitude pretty easily. But really, that's just taking a positive outlook on things. So it first requires me to put myself in the other person's shoes, even for just a moment, just to think about what it took out of their day, even if it was just a small sacrifice, or even wasn't a sacrifice at all, maybe it was just a kind word, for them to do whatever it is for me that I'm being grateful for right now. And that led into what, furthermore, can I do to not only accept their kindness, but really share with them how joyful it's made me. Because for me, that's what gratitude really is sharing back, you know, something that you got. And I haven't quite figured out how to do this yet because, you know, these are just thoughts that I've had. Anyway, in closing, you know, I would just like to say thank you again for welcoming me into this fellowship and giving me a chance to really take a look at myself and share it.
I began by asking myself, when has gratitude surprised me? And the answer, this fall, as I found myself grateful, actually grateful, for the heartbreaking conversations opening up in our country around racism and misogyny. And I'm also surprised today, as those same conversations seem to be in peril, in danger of being smoothed over and silenced. I still find myself grateful that we ever had this opening, this sort of thaw. It was like a thaw of the rigid social mores that keep many Americans from speaking openly about systemic oppression that still exists today due to concepts of race and concepts of gender and many other things. So during this strange autumnal election season, I had read a story. And for all that we know to be true about the ubiquitous fake news on social media, I have to admit that I might never have seen this story if it weren't for Facebook, so I'm going to express some gratitude for Facebook. A repost from the Huffington Post had come up in my feed, and it was actually real news. It was from a legitimate source, so I followed the HuffPost link to the original piece in the Washington Post newspaper online. The headline read, "The White Flight of Derek Black." And by the way, I want to note that if you ever go to look up his story, I have a typo in the order of service. It is Derek, not Daryl. The White Flight of Derek Black. Under the author's byline was a picture of a handsome, young, red-haired man. He was quietly smiling. The image caption read, "Derek Black, 27, was following in his father's footsteps as a white nationalist leader until he began to question the movement's ideology." I continued to read as Washington Post journalist Eli Saslow unfolded the story of a young man named Derek Black, not a name I knew, but as I kept reading, his family associations led to names I had heard of in the context of what I feel to be the worst our country has to offer, American hate speech and white supremacist propaganda. As the Washington Post reporter made clear, Derek Black is the son of Don Black, a prominent white nationalist ideologue and founder of a white supremacist forum called Stormfront. Let me be clear, this is a story of a young man who was raised at the epicenter of a hate movement that is the very antithesis of our UU values. To set the stage for why this story has moved me to gratitude, I must read a paragraph from the article. From the very beginning, Derek Black's life had taken place within the insular world of white nationalism, where there was never any doubt about what whiteness could mean in the United States. Derek had been taught that America was intended as a place for white Europeans, that everyone else would eventually have to leave. He was told to be suspicious of other races, of the US government, of tap water, and of pop culture. His parents pulled him out of school in West Palm Beach at the end of third grade. By then, Derek was one of only a few white students in a class of mostly Hispanic and Haitian students, and his parents decided he'd be better off at home. I quote, "It's a shame how many white minds are wasted in that system," Derek wrote himself shortly thereafter on the Stormfront Children's website he built at age 10. Derek Black was a young man being groomed as a leader, the new hope of white nationalism. By age 19, as a community college student, Derek Black was already hosting his own radio show. He had launched a white nationalist website for children and won a local political position on the Republican committee in Palm Beach County, Florida. And if you are beginning to zone out and think, I do not want to hear about this on a Sunday morning, just bear with me, because I understand. As I read this article, I thought, I do not want to read about this young man. As the Washington Post writer described, he decided he wanted to study medieval European history. So he applied to the New College of Florida, a top-ranked liberal arts school with a strong history program. He attended an introductory college meeting about diversity and concluded that the quickest way to be ostracized was to proclaim himself a racist. He decided not to mention white nationalism on campus, at least until he had made some friends. And he did make friends. He kept his views close to his chest, even as he continued to broadcast on his father's radio show. I'm quoting the article now. Gradually, he went from keeping his convictions quiet to actively disguising them. He then left after just one semester of study to study abroad in Germany because he wanted to learn the language. He kept in touch with New College partly through a student message board known as the Forum, whose updates were automatically sent to his email. One night in April 2011, Derek noticed a message posted to all students at 1:56 a.m. in the morning. It was written by someone Derek didn't know. An upperclassman had been researching terrorist groups online when he stumbled across a familiar face. "Have you seen this man?" the message read, and beneath those words was a picture that was unmistakable, the red hair, the cowboy hat. Quote, "Derek Black, white supremacist, radio host, New College student, ?" The post read, "How do we as a community respond?" By the time Derek returned to campus for the next semester, more than 1,000 responses had been written to that post. It was the biggest message thread in the history of the school that Derek now wanted badly to avoid. He returned to Sarasota from his study abroad, applied for permission to live outside of required student housing, and rented a room a few miles away. A few of his friends from the previous year emailed to say they felt betrayed, probably what I myself would have done in the situation, and strangers sometimes flipped him off from a safe distance on campus. I can't say that I wouldn't have done that either. But for the most part, Derek avoided public spaces, and other students mostly stared or left him alone, even as their speculation about him continued on the forum. Quote, "Maybe he's trying to get away from a life he didn't choose." Quote, "He chooses to be a racist public figure. We choose to call him a racist in public." Quote, "I'd like to see Derek Black respond to all of this." Instead of replying, Derek read the forum and used it as a motivation to plan a conference for young white nationalists in East Tennessee. Another New College student learned about the conference and posted details on the forum, where gradually a new way of thinking had begun to emerge. Quote, "Ostracizing Derek won't accomplish anything," one student wrote. "We have a chance to be real activists and actually affect one of the leaders of white supremacy in America. This is not an exaggeration," the student wrote. "It would be a victory for civil rights." Quote, "Who's clever enough to think of something we can do to change this guy's mind?" One of Derek's acquaintances from that first semester decided he might have an idea. He started reading Stormfront and listening to Derek's radio show. Then, in late September, he sent Derek a text message. "What are you doing Friday night?" he wrote. And here comes the part of this story which really surprised me. Matthew Stevenson had started hosting weekly Shabbat dinners at his campus apartment shortly after enrolling in New College in 2010. He was the only Orthodox Jew at the school, and it's a school with little Jewish infrastructure, so he began cooking for a small group of students at his apartment almost every Friday night. Matthew always said the traditional prayers, but most of his guests were Christian, atheist, Black or Hispanic, anyone open-minded enough to listen to a few blessings in Hebrew. Now, in the fall of 2011, Matthew invited Derek to join them. Matthew had spent a few weeks debating whether it was a good idea. He and Derek had lived near each other in the dorm, but they hadn't spoken since Derek was exposed on the forum. Matthew, who almost always wore a yarmulke, had experienced enough anti-Semitism in his life to be familiar with the KKK, David Duke, and Stormfront. He went back and read some of Derek's posts on the site from 2007 and 2008. These posts, they said horrible things. Matthew decided his best chance to affect Derek's thinking was not to ignore him or confront him, but simply to include him. Maybe he'd never spent time with a Jewish person before, Matthew remembered thinking. It was the only social invitation Derek had received since returning to campus, so he agreed to go. The Shabbat meals had sometimes included 8 or 10 students, but this time only a few showed up. "Let's try to treat him like anyone else," Matthew remembered instructing them. Derek arrived with a bottle of wine. Nobody mentioned white nationalism or the forum out of respect for Matthew. Derek was quiet and polite, and he came back the next week and then the next, until after a few months, nobody felt all that threatened, and the Shabbat group grew back to its original size. On the rare occasions when Derek directed conversation during those dinners, it was about the particulars of Arabic grammar or marine aquatics or the roots of Christianity in medieval times. He came across as smart and curious, and mostly he listened. He heard a Peruvian immigrant tell stories about attending a high school that was 90% Hispanic. He asked Matthew about his opinions on Israel and Palestine. They were both still wary of each other. Derek wondered whether Matthew was trying to get him drunk so he would say offensive things that would later appear on the forum. Matthew wondered whether Derek was trying to cultivate a Jewish friend to protect himself against charges of anti-Semitism. But they also liked each other, and they started playing pool at a bar near the campus. I think I've read enough that you might suspect where this story is going. Gradually, Derek began to respond online to the questions of his peers on the campus message board, demanding to know who he was and what he believed. As he replied, his views softened and changed. They shifted, not overnight, but over months. At some point, the Southern Poverty Law Center contacted Derek, asking if indeed he was no longer aligned to the white nationalist ideology of his family. And for those who aren't familiar with the SPLC, they're a civil rights watchdog group that, among other things, keeps public files on hate speech activities. Derek was slow to respond. His own identity, his most deeply held beliefs, were still shifting. Finally, in 2013, Derek Black sent a reply to SPLC. In the message, he disaffiliated himself from Stormfront and from the entire white nationalist movement. He gave permission to SPLC to publish the letter in full. This was a young man's coming out as a recovering racist. Eli Saslow's article for the Washington Post wraps it up. Every day since then, Derek has been working to put distance between himself and his past. He was still living across the country from his family after finishing his master's degree, and he was starting to learn Arabic to be able to study the history of early Islam. He hadn't spoken to anyone in white nationalism since his defection, aside from occasional calls home to his parents. Instead, he spent his time catching up on aspects of pop culture he'd once been taught to discredit: liberal newspaper columns, rap music, and Hollywood movies. He'd come to admire President Obama. He decided to trust the U.S. government. He started drinking tap water. He had taken budget trips to Barcelona, Paris, Dublin, Nicaragua, and Morocco, immersing himself in as many cultures as he could. He joined a new online message group, this one for couch surfers, and he opened up his one-bedroom apartment to strangers looking for a temporary place to stay. He said it felt increasingly good to trust people, to try to interact without prejudice or judgment. And after a while, Derek began to feel detached from the person that he had been. As I read this online article in October, I was stunned. I was shocked, really, by a new knowledge of hope that I didn't even know existed. How could Derek Black recover from a childhood upbringing at the epicenter of hatred and division? How did his friend Matthew Stevenson find the strength to offer Derek Black companionship, even knowing about his hideous beliefs? As I continued to reflect upon the story of Derek Black, I'm surprised that this story makes me thankful, but it does. The story makes me feel that a more flexible way of being, one I may never have known existed, is possible. I feel grateful for the fortitude and patience of Derek Black's friend, Matthew, who took a chance that radical hospitality could change a heart. And I feel grateful for the almost magical flexibility of mind and growth in spirit that has been shown through Derek Black. I have a bad habit of looking at the New York Times right before bed every night on my phone. It's one way that insomnia continues to be a part of my life. And as I looked at it about 1 a.m. last night, there is a opinion piece, a reflection by Derek Black in today's Times about how he left that movement. So he continues to speak out and to try, and as he has said, he wants to try and correct some of what he did, even as a child, promoting this movement. So this story gave me a new model to answer that question that was posed by the college students on the message board. How do we respond as a community? It gave me a new way to think about that. Now we'd like to invite you to do something a little different. We don't often have participatory moments together during our service. I would like to invite all of you, each of you, to join us in reflecting upon when gratitude has surprised you. It could be surprising gratitude. It could just be something that you are thankful for. And join us in building a fall bouquet. I'd like to invite you up to this table over here to my left. Take a stem from the baskets, or actually it's just laid on the table. No baskets. Take a stem. Come up to the lectern. Share what you're grateful for. And place that stem in our vase.
I want to do the kind of participatory gratitude that Matthew was talking about, because last Tuesday night, something happened in Aggieville that I'm very grateful for. I was walking down the street with my wife, and we're going to go into a coffee shop there, and a young woman ran up to me and hugged me. That was Alex. And I'm grateful to Alex, and let me tell you why I'm grateful. So you don't worry about a hidden agenda. Here is the hidden agenda. I have a bad habit of beating up on myself for my failures, which are many. And to get that sort of affirmation spontaneously improved my day 1,000%. Thank you, Alex.
Oh, that was great. I've enjoyed this whole program. And truly, a free hug out of nowhere is one of the most surprising and wonderful things we can be grateful for in life. But honestly, I realized when Alex was speaking, being grateful can be nearly impossible at times in life. And we all have experienced times when we couldn't think of anything but the things that were bearing down on us. I like to think of gratitude as a practice. So I like to think about gratitude awareness as being something that if we just sort of like when you're brushing your teeth or something that you just do every day naturally, make that time a time to go over in your mind. What has it been in the past day that you are grateful for? And there's always something. It's always something. For me personally, I remember the surprise when I first heard my mother in her waning years. She was probably in her mid-80s at the time. You know, with 15 more years of life to go. And things were hard for her then. And I remember that when things were difficult, she had a mantra that she began to repeat. And that was, I've led a very fortunate life. I've had a very fortunate life, she would say. And it seemed to be really from the heart, that she really was feeling that. But in fact, I know she was also comforting herself. So other thing I'd like to say about gratitude is that we're not always in control. And when we let go of thinking that we are in control, and we feel the humility of that, we do open a door to gratitude. But when we're always trying to be in control, things don't always seem to be working, and there's always something to complain about. So if we just accept the fact that we're not in control, that is a big step towards receiving those unexpected hugs that come our way. And I'm grateful for so many unexpected hugs, in quotes, that come my way every day. And I would say this congregation is one of the big ones for me. So thank you.
I'm grateful to be happy.
I'm so grateful for this fellowship, for all the people who expend all the energy that they do to make it thrive and make it work and make it grow. And I've supported the Southern Poverty Law Center, and I read that story when they published it, and it was pretty remarkable, and I thank you for bringing that forward. And my gratitude today is for a trip that I took to the Northern Cheyenne Reservation with some friends, and 400 people were camped on their grounds, and we were amazed to have been invited to the Northern Cheyenne Reservation. And then we learned that they were offering lodges, sweat lodges. So I was even more amazed that they would open their hearts and share this sacrament with us. And I felt a little shaky about participating, so I thought I'd go up and look and see how things were going. And if there were a lot of people, I wasn't going to try to participate. When I got up there, there were three big fires going, and there were two lodges. And their lodges are very small. It's kind of like just a little capsule, just a little domed capsule for about 10 people, 10 to 12 people. And there was a man who was tending the fires, and he was kind of stumbling around. He just seemed a little unsteady. And I thought, oh my God, that man is drunk. And we had been told, do not bring any alcohol onto this reservation. I went, well, there aren't very many people, and so I'll go get my dress and I'll come back. And when I came back, that man was still there. And then at one point someone said, okay, line up, and we got into one little lodge. And who do you think came into the lodge as the lodge leader? The man that I had seen sort of stumbling around, he wasn't drunk at all, not remotely. He had just been tending the fires and humbly keeping his head down. And to begin our evening's lodge, you know, you don't talk about the particulars of what happens in a lodge, but I know that he shared this with us so that we would remember it, because first he started with sort of a joke, because as he came into the lodge, he didn't say anything, and the people who were in the lodge were all talking and introducing themselves, and all this conversation and buzz was going on, and finally he goes, we all know that you all know everything, and you got to talk about it. But now let's be quiet. We're going to begin. And then he said, the only reason we still have a culture is because we follow this protocol. The only reason we still have our culture is because we follow this protocol. And then he shared the protocol, which is, you know, not so remarkable because it follows the four seasons. But in the lodge, when you do each of the four directions, you start with birth, And there, you know, he was telling us how we were going to participate in this lodge, because we had no idea. Every tribe's and every community's lodge is different. He said, you start as an infant. You're helpless. Everything is done for you. And your mother teaches you how to be a human being. So that's the first direction. He said, and you people who started off, be careful what you say. He said, the next direction, the south, here you're becoming a human being on your own, and you're in your teens, and you're really developing. Watch what you say, but also use what you heard before you. Then when you get to be an adult, now you're really contributing. Then when you get to the winter and the north direction, it's going to be time for you to leave soon. And that man blessed all of us. We were strangers. And he opened us up to their protocol and the wisdom of keeping that in mind. So I'm grateful.
Hi, my name is Les Loschke, and this is my second time here. And my wife, Mickey, and I came a couple of weeks ago after the election. We really were feeling hard to put words on it, but very down about how things are going nationally. So. And my wife said, let's go to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. And I'd grown up with that as a kid, but we'd never come here in the 14 years we lived here except for a memorial for a friend. So just being able to come here and feel the fellowship, it's really uplifting. And it's exactly what we were hoping to get by coming here. And so I am deeply grateful to be able to join you guys, and also to all the speakers today who were talking about gratitude. I learned a lot just by listening to it. So thank you.
I want to thank all of you people who spoke. It was really wonderful and instructive. And a while ago, maybe a couple years ago, Alex, you asked someone actually recommended me as a possible mentor when you were looking for a mentor. And I guess it looks from the outside, I have three daughters, like I've been a good mom, but I've been struggling for several years with the feeling that I've been a total failure because my girls have lots of problems. And so I had struggled with maybe what your mom's philosophy was, that, okay, they're adults, I'll just let them flop around. But I've hung in there with them. I learned a whole lot from you. One of my daughters has suffered from, was suicidal for at least 10 years. And she probably still harbors thoughts like that. And I have told her that she should be grateful for her life. And you've given me a new understanding of how I have possibly been dismissive of her feelings. Anyway, I learned so much from all of you. And you too, Katie. So thank you for giving me the chance to learn from people older than me, my age, and younger than me, who have so much to teach me. And I'm grateful that you found Katie, who has really been a good mentor for you.
I'm grateful for a happy marriage. Anybody who out there who has ever been in a bad situation, a scary, toxic, unhealthy, unsafe marriage probably knows what I mean. It was great to hope that maybe this relationship would be everything I wanted to be, and it has been. We've been married 18 years, and I'm so grateful.
Hello. My name's Sarah. I'm new today. Actually, this is my first day coming here. I'm grateful for a few things. That's why I grabbed this multiple flower one here. I want to say that I'm grateful for you guys for letting me come here. I am grateful for being here in Kansas, and mainly I am grateful for my friend and roommate, Matt, here. He's awesome. I met him about 3 months ago almost in the Manhattan Homeless Emergency Shelter after a really rough patch in my life, and the shelter actually kicked me out because I didn't have my Social Security card and everything quick enough to get a job for them. So they told me I had to leave, and I had basically no options. But this guy right here turned around and put aside any of his plans that he may have had in order to get a two-bedroom apartment and to be my roommate and to make sure I had a place to be safe and warm for the winter. And I'm really appreciative of it. Sorry, I'm super nervous right now, but I really do want to say thank you, Matt. I appreciate it. You're awesome. Great.
I'm grateful for my old father. <laughs> 2013 was a very, very bad year for me. I had two strokes and a heart attack. The first stroke was in Ireland when we were on a tour, and I was in Irish hospital for a good month. It was a bad month. And then we came back here, and I felt pretty good until September, when I didn't feel as good. We called 911. I was rushed to the emergency room. I was having a heart attack. The next day, I had a stroke, and that stroke is still with me. But I'm grateful to be alive. That gratitude is somewhat tempered by the fact that in less than 2 months, Donald Trump will be president of the United States. But whatever.
Hi, I'm Kristen Corwin. About a year ago, I had to take a personality test that ranked 12 properties of a person, justice, and things we value. And number one for me was gratitude. So I'm grateful for everything, and I use it as a weapon myself against insecurity, inadequacy, anxiety, everything that seeks to cloud my sense of well-being. But I realize that I get extremely frustrated with people in my life who express something other than gratitude. And I'm very thankful for having a better understanding of that today, that just because I feel gratitude for my life or my parents or my job, it doesn't mean I can just be extra grateful and have it rub off on the person next to me. And I today have developed a much better sense of being mindful of their feelings and their lack of gratitude and to be respectful of it. And so I thank you very much for teaching me that, just like Sylvia said. And thank you all for this morning and your fellowship.
Good morning. It's kind of hard when you get to be silver hair, as many of us are. We've lived a long life, and I'm very grateful for my life. There have been problems, but growing up in Mexico, I learned to be, I was in the minority. Graceful, wonderful people. You learned to be tolerant as a child to all the wonderful people who are around you. meeting Brandt, spending 60 wonderful years, I'm very grateful for. And for the UU fellowships that we joined when we were dating in 1950. And over the years, it's been a wonderful community and the different ones that we have attended and enjoyed our friendship with so many different friends. I am very grateful for all these wonderful years, and I hope that we can continue to be grateful over the next 4 years. Through knowledge and experience, I am very worried, but I do hope that we can be strong together, do what we need to do, and be very grateful for this wonderful country.
Good morning. I'll just be brief. I'm grateful for everybody here today, this day. And also, I saw my dad Friday, who's 94, and very emotional he was, and he hasn't been. And I'm so grateful he's still around. And I'm grateful for Alex and Matt being here, our spirit family. They're great people. You know, I respect them a lot. So thank you all.
I had to make this announcement because I forgot to hand in an announcement. It's time to take down our wall hangings, and there are a few of you who have not signed these, and every person's signature is to be on a leaf. There are different colors, and there are different sizes. You can choose an empty one. There's quite a few empty ones. Ann Martian and I designed these to be signed for each leaf to represent a member, and the stem is the fellowship itself. The branches might be the UU classes, the RE classes, and each leaf is to be signed by. And I have three pens, and maybe I have a pole back there that hopefully some athletic person will lift that off, and maybe we can put one across the piano, and you can sign right after. Okay. All right.
Stand as you are able and sing 346, Come Self Song.
Thank you.
ever in my view a vision of the full span of my life. May I have faith that my life has meaning. May I meet adversity with courage and hope. As the earth spreads out from me to the horizon, may my soul expand to embrace it. I give thanks that I have risen again today into the great rising of life itself.